This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, June 19th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll speak with Manicotick's mayor about the future possibility of a road to Dillingham.
That we will get this road moving along. And I'm hoping to be the first one driving down to Dillingham.
We'll check in with the Fisheries Research Institute on the work they'll be doing around Bristol Bay this summer.
You know, part of our focus is asking what aspects of these watersheds up here are most important for maintaining these productive salmon runs.
And we'll look north to the Kuskokwim River, where the salmon runs are lean and the fishing is being restricted. Plus, we'll tag along as some junior local sport fish guides take clients out for a day fly fishing in Bristol Bay.
Well, I'm trying to teach you how to cast first.
No, but I mean, that's what I mean. Can we possibly, like...
Yeah.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Bristol Bay salmon season is slowly getting going, with most of the commercial efforts so far centered in Igigik. Earlier this week, area manager Paul Solomon said the first catches from Monday were small in number and small in size, too.
I wouldn't go real far with that and try to compare a couple hundred fish to the potential 50 million we may have coming. But what we've seen so far has been small and underweight.
The Port Moeller Test Fishery reported last night that their catches had picked up across all stations, as had the average sizes of the sockeye caught. Elsewhere in the district, counting projects got started over the week, including the Wood River, which went up 5 days earlier than usual. Atop the tower last Saturday morning, Fishing Game's Matt Jones explained the importance of the project as his technician waited to count the first sockeye of the year.
We can't do any kind of management without getting these counts. It's blind fishing, which is a real dangerous, scary term, not knowing what you're fishing on, how big that run is, uncertainty with having the fishery open too long, sound management, knowing our escapement.
As much of the fleet waits for escapement to build, some found other ways to spend time during the dog days of summer. KDLG News found a dozen or so in a homemade pool in the PAF boatyard earlier this week. Jordan Willis built it out of spare lumber and a tarp.
I made a pool out of 2x4s, tarp, and rope because it was way too hot today.
How hot is it right now?
Well, I thermaled the air around the boat and said 94, and my reefer unit's saying 93 down in the bilge, so it's in the 90s, I think.
On Monday morning, the long-awaited Wood River Bridge took a major step towards being completed as the last steel beam spanning the river on the permanent bridge was set in place. Builder Tim Hutton says it was a proud moment for he and the crew that have been working on the bridge since last year.
Erection week is the best week. Yeah, putting the girders up, I always find to be the best. Yeah, the best. Absolutely. That and then when you're finished, right?
The $20 million project to connect the north and south shores of Aleknagik is expected to be completed later this fall. In Dillingham, drivers have waited in unusually long traffic while construction work continues at the Airport Y culvert and the resurfacing of Kanakanak Road to downtown. DOT spokesperson Jill Reese says the plan is to have the road reopened to normal traffic by the first part of next week.
They're going to be backfilling the big culverts tomorrow, and then after that, then they'll be paving in earnest.
That was Reese speaking earlier in the week. She says there was some delay in how long the cement base for the new culvert needed to set. The city of Dillingham is moving forward with another attempt at annexing the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District for the purpose of collecting a 2.5% raw fish tax. Here's Mayor Alice Ruby speaking Wednesday.
The local boundary commission notified us that they had accepted our petition as filed. And what that means, you know, for the last couple of months, we've been first filed it. They had some items that they had identified that needed to be addressed, which we did, resubmitted it. Now this is the formal notice that the petition is considered filed.
And she says that opens a public comment process through October 1st. Ruby says the city hopes to see the tax levied by the 2016 fishing season, but delays by the city council last fall may have moved that back now till 2017. Telecom company GCI says upgrades to Terra, the broadband network from Leavelock to Kotzebue, are underway, and that may cause some slowed service this summer. David Morris is a spokesman for the company.
What we'll be doing is essentially grooming the traffic to make it more efficiently carried. We'll be adding additional radios to support more capacity as well.
That slowdown could affect internet and 3G data service on cell phones. In other news, King Cove residents are celebrating a new bill by Senator Lisa Murkowski that may force a land swap between the federal government and the state and King Cove Tribal Corporation. That swap will allow for a road to be built through the Eisenbeck Refuge. The Cleveland volcano in the east central Aleutians has been heating up after a period of relative calm. And in our crime and safety beat, borough police seized approximately 38 grams of heroin and other narcotics in a drug bust at the King Salmon Airport last week. They placed Jordan Bishop, age 27, of Palmer, under arrest on a drug charge. Andrew Yvonne, age 49, from Manicotic, was arrested this week for the alleged first-degree rape of a woman at the Dillingham Hotel. And 21-year-old Kaylin Kalmakoff, originally from Chignik Bay, was arrested last week, for the alleged sex abuse of a 6-year-old girl in the village. More on the week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. We're going to start this week's show with a look north, where residents all along the Kuskokwim River will be facing restrictions against subsistence fishing for king salmon as the river faces another predicted down year. Joining me for an update is Ben Matheson, a reporter at KYUK in Bethel, who's been covering the Kuskokwim subsistence fishery all year long. Ben, good to speak with you this Friday morning. Thanks for coming back on our program.
Thank you, Dave.
What's happening with the Kuskokwim King Run this weekend? Can you give us an update?
Well, there is a lot of concern about the health of that King Run. So set net fishing, which had been taking place the last several weekends, is shut down this weekend on the lower river. That's from Tulixac down to the mouth. There's numbers coming into the Bethel test fishery that are well below those of 2014, where we had a similar set of heavy restrictions. We've had more restrictions, though, with keeping that set net fishing limited to 4-inch nets intended for whitefish nets on the weekends, but still the numbers aren't great. There's also reports that a lot of people are putting those nets in spaces where they catch a lot of king salmon, and they're targeting king salmon is certainly what managers have said. Some with larger gear, they've seized a total of 51 nets this season so far. So that set net fishing takes a toll, and this weekend it's shut down to protect the kings.
There is an opening somewhere on the river, right?
If you go far upriver, that's beyond where the federal managers have jurisdiction, to state waters above Aniak, there is a very limited elders fishery. That's for people age 60 and older. They have about 4 hours to catch king salmon. And it's a bit about having fair access to the resource. There's been a lot more opportunities on the lower river and some directed king salmon fishing in terms of a community permit. But upriver hasn't had that same opportunity until this Saturday.
Ben, who's managing this fishery? There had been this kind of shift between the state and the feds, I believe, right?
Right now, the federal managers are in control of everything within the Yukon Delta Refuge. That's from Aniak down to the mouth, while the state manages from Aniak all the way up to the headwaters to McGrath and Nikolai. The vast majority of the people certainly live within the refuge. The lower river is where all the fishing power really is. Above that, communities have much smaller populations, and this year have a bit of different rules. And that's the beauty of dual management, is that you get different rules and different systems. There's friction that comes with that.
Is there some confusion as well, I would imagine?
After last year, in which we had a similar set of heavy restrictions, there appears to be less confusion. But as the rules have kind of changed, we've had a weekend set net fishing where we allow the 4-inch set nets on the lower river. That schedule has certainly caused some confusion, and I know that managers have cited a lot of people on Sundays. That's the day when the set net fishing period closes. So there's certainly some confusion, but we've had a number of years of restrictions, and people are in some way adjusting to those restrictions.
You've been at all of these meetings all spring as some of these things have been hashed out. What's the level of frustration with the people who live in along the Kuskokwim and count on these fish?
I don't think I would be out of order to say that level of frustration is high. There's a lot of people who have a high dependence on king salmon, and especially king salmon. They're the first, they're the biggest, they're the most nutritious. They come at the time when you still have good weather where you can hang them up, dry them, and put them away as dry fish. later in the season, you get smaller fish with the red run, the chum run, and you get poor weather. So the king run is the essential run. It is Alaska's biggest subsistence fishery.
Ben, can you characterize the strength of this year's king salmon run on the Kuskokwim, but also are you hearing of any hope that it will rebound in the near future?
This year was, again, predicted to be a well below average run, the range of some 96,000 to 163,000 king salmon. If we get on the lower end of that, we're barely making the escapement. So a very, very small harvest can impact the river's escapement goals in down years like this. We've heard no promises of future returns. I think managers don't know exactly what's caused the King Run crash. It could be any number of factors, and we believe it is a number of factors. So there's no assurances, but managers do know that there is incredible fishing power on this river. If harvest goes unchecked, this river has the power to take out a huge number of those fish and seriously compromise future runs. So conservation is certainly the name of the game this summer, although the future is as uncertain as ever.
Ben Matheson, reporter at KYUK in Bethel, thank you for the update this Friday morning. Good to speak with you.
Thanks, Dave. Have a great weekend.
Salmon draw many back to Bristol Bay each summer, some to pick nets, others to toss flies, and still others to resume the annual collection of important data on the region's premier resource. A team of grad students and faculty from the University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute spend several months in Bristol Bay every summer, and their research and data, collected over some seven decades, plays a crucial role in the understanding and management of the fishery and the ecosystem. Earlier this week, I spoke with University of Washington Professor Daniel Schindler about what FRI will be up to this summer and a little on the history of the program.
FRI started work up here in 1946, about a time when the returns to Bristol Bay were declining, and the canneries were wondering what was causing the decline, and they were concerned about over-harvest. And, we've been monitoring a lot of these streams and spawning grounds continuously since then.
And that's it's kind of important to point out that's before the state got involved, before it was a state. And so state research and FRI has been certainly the most consistent and longest lasting set of data, I would guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the initial efforts by FRI was asking some really simple questions like, how do you count the number of fish that swim up a river? And that turned into what is now the counting towers. And they also started some work sampling the juvenile sockeye salmon in their in the lake and streams, and some of the food resources that they feed on.
Does it ever strike you as odd that we still use the same technology, the counting towers that was developed that, seven decades ago or six decades ago by FRI?
Well, you know, if it's not broken, there's no sense fixing it. So it seems to be an effective method in most places, particularly in these remote and sometimes complicated rivers to work in. And it seems to be a reasonable way to enumerate the fish.
What's on the agenda this year?
The research program we run is really focused on the entire freshwater components of the sockeye life cycle. So that includes after the fish swim upstream and are counted at the counting towers, they distribute throughout the watershed. So one of our long-running data sets is to hike up these spawning streams and count how many fish have spawned there. We also, after they've died, we cut open their heads and pull out their ear bones, and from those we can age them. And there's some of our work by graduate students and some of the faculty are looking at questions about where do they spawn in these streams? Do they spawn before bears eat them? Whole bunch of questions there. And then we also follow that the rest of the life cycle after they emerge from the gravel in the spring and swim down into the lakes. We sample them with beach stains and assess how fast they're growing in the spring. And eventually they move offshore into the deep water by late summer, and then we sample them again. That's at night when they migrate up to the surface, and we capture them in tow nets there. And then in the spring again, we're watching them leave the system as smolts. So right now we're running our smolt gear at the outlet of Lake Aleknagik. And interesting year this year, there's a ton of smolts leaving, and they're really big. Probably a reflection of the warm summer last year and the warm spring this year.
Where all are you and the staff located?
So most of our activity is really based out of Aleknagik. We have a field camp here, and then we have another station up on Second Lake, and there's a sizable crew there as well. We have another field camp over on Lake Iliamna, and then another small camp out on the Chignik watershed out on the peninsula.
Daniel, do you have any research projects that are new to this year?
Yeah, so the otolith project is relatively new to us. We're sampling both the sockeye going up the Nooshigak and also the Chinook going up the Nooshigak, and this is a continuation of Sean Brennan's work. And there, we're doing two things. One, we're really establishing the baseline conditions in the water chemistry throughout the Nooshigak, but then from sampling the otoliths of the returning adults, we can figure out where in the watershed were they born, and then which tributaries did they use as habitats as they grew up in freshwater and moved out to the ocean. That's really the big new project we have this year.
It seems to me like there's a real importance and a real focus on the consistent collection of data for that entire life cycle like you were talking about there.
Yeah, it's the long-term monitoring that in a lot of ways is fairly straightforward, simple techniques, but the power of it is in the consistency. And from that, we can do things like pull out how changes in climate have affected the growth and the survival of the fish. In the Wood River here, we see that warmer conditions like we're seeing this summer actually translate into better growing conditions for the juvenile salmon. But we can only detect that type of effect by having 50 years of data to look at.
What's the importance of the work that you're doing, and how does it translate? You know, our audience right now may be a lot of the fishermen and fisherwomen out there, and what's the importance to them as you continue to collect this data over all these years?
Well, the hope is always that our information will improve our ability to forecast how many fish are returning next year. It turns out that forecasting is more challenging than we often like to admit. But the other thing it does is give us a better understanding of explaining why runs are poor if they're poor in any given year or strong in others. And then the other thing our data really bear on is assessing what aspects of these ecosystems is particularly important for the salmon. And you know, in the lower 48 and even in British Columbia, the watersheds are being developed or have been developed, and the salmon runs there aren't as strong. And, you know, part of our focus is asking what aspects of these watersheds up here are most important for maintaining these productive salmon runs.
Daniel Schindler, it's been great speaking with you, and thanks so much for the time.
Good. Thanks for your interest, and good luck to all the fishermen out there.
And we have much more from that interview with Daniel Schindler, including his thoughts on the health of the watershed and whether or not overescapement in Bristol Bay Rivers is a problem biologically speaking. Hint, he says it's not. We'll have part two on this weekend's Bristol Bay Fisheries Report and posted online at kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. A week at a sport fishing lodge in Bristol Bay costs tourists thousands of dollars. It's a major regional industry, but it's largely owned and operated by outsiders. Well, for the past 7 years, a mosaic of organizations including the Bristol Bay Heritage Land Trust, Trout Unlimited, and BBEDC have run and sponsored the Bristol Bay River and Guide Academy with hopes to train local kids in the art of fly fishing and guiding. The students spend a week at a lodge learning to be guides. KDLG's Matt Martin met up with them at this year's Academy at Kulik Lodge on the last day.
Jet boats hydroplane up Kulik River and float planes skip across Lake Nonvionic as Kulik Lodge comes alive for a day of fishing. David Parks, Jr. of Iliamna, is one of 15 students at the Guide Academy. He stands in the crystal clear water of the Kulik with Sarah Pearl.
So could we possibly catch something right now?
Well, I'm trying to teach you how to cast first.
No, but I mean, that's what I mean. Can we possibly, like...
Yeah. If they're right there.
Oh, okay.
Pearl works as a housekeeper at the Kulik Lodge, but today she'll pretend to be a client so Parks can test the fly fishing and customer service skills he learned this week. Before this week, Parks had never fly fished. He'd always liked fishing, but grew up with only a typical rod and reel.
It was either that or ice fishing.
The first time he ever picked up a fly rod was the first day of class.
The next day we had to come out here and fish, and so I spent like half the time just swaying my rod back and forth, just trying to get that perfect swing.
Now, after just learning the skills himself, Park teaches Pearl, another novice, the finer points of casting with a fly rod.
As soon as you feel it tighten, is that better?
Yeah. There you go.
The students had a week-long crash course in fly fishing and what it takes to be a guide.
Like tying flies and making leaders and making sure we had all our customer service skills down.
Sonny Peterson is the owner of the Kulik Lodge. He currently doesn't have any Bristol Bay locals working for him, but he says they add a great value to the services that a lodge like his can provide.
People come up there and they ask where you're from, and your guide says he's from New York or Florida. You know, it doesn't sound as good as if he says I'm from Agiogic or Non-Dalton.
The Bristol Bay River and Guide Academy was founded in part by Tim Troll. He is also the head of the Bristol Bay Land Trust. Troll says the time is about right for locals to play a bigger role in the lodge industry.
It took 70 years in the commercial fishery before locals really broke into the commercial fishery, and now the lodge industry has been here about 70 years.
Troll used to be the president of Chogyung Limited in Dillingham. The native corporation owns a sport fishing lodge, and he says shareholders would often ask him why no locals worked in the lodge.
And I asked the operator that, and he said, well, I need guys who fly fish. And Bristol Bay wasn't producing any local fly fishermen. There were maybe a handful. So that sort of planted the idea in the back of my head is that if we are going to serve that industry, we have to produce somebody who can fly fish.
In 2008, Troll was finally able to see that idea come to life with the first Guide Academy. This is the seventh. And roughly 80 students have passed through the program, and four have been placed as permanent employees and a few other internships at sport lodges in the region. Troll says that even if most of the students don't get jobs at a lodge, they can learn about an industry that is all around them. He says many of these students may someday be leaders in their native corporations, which often own or lease land to lodges.
Just understanding the industry, how it works, how it operates, and also lodges from the other side, understanding what village corporations are all about and trying to deal fairly with everybody and make it work.
He also says it's a way for kids to get exposure to people from all over the world.
Business leaders of the world come here. You get to mingle with these people. And who knows where that can take somebody.
Troll doesn't think the lodge industry will ever be a major employer in the region, but it could be a significant one. Sonny Peterson, owner of the Kulik Lodge, says a major hurdle to hiring local guides is that the work is only seasonal.
You know, a local kid here, it's tough for him because, you know, once this is over, that's it, you know. And unless they can figure out something to do the rest of the year.
David Parks, Jr. from Iliamna, echoes that concern.
It's hard to have just a seasonal job with, like, a box of Tide soap costing like $30, $40.
Parks will be starting a new job at the post office when he gets back to Iliamna, but he would love the chance to work at a lodge if he could.
I mean, if I had a job that would allow me to take like a month off during the summer, I'd do this job during the summers.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll work in a school.
There you go.
Work in the school in the winters. Be a guide in the summer.
Whatever career path lies ahead for Parks, it's evident that this academy has left an impression on him. Reporting from Kulik Lodge, I'm Matt Martin.
Finally this week, part of the charm of Southwest Alaska is our separation from the rest of the world, the quiet solitude of being unconnected, a plane or boat or snow machine ride away from our nearest neighbors. But that's also limiting, of course, especially within our region. The long view holds that more of our villages could or should be connected by road, and right now there is an honest effort underway to study what it will take to build a road between Dillingham and Manicotic. Melvin Andrew is the mayor of Manicotic, and I spoke with him last week, just after he'd flown over for a visit with Dillingham City officials, about how to move this vision forward.
For the past 20 years, 20-plus years, there's been a couple of more proposals to make a road or connect a road to Dillingham, but they were not accepted.
But Andrew says in the past 10 years, with the rising cost of fuel, Manicotic residents have been calling for action. He says he and Dillingham Mayor Alice Ruby sat down over a cup of coffee to talk about the possibility of a road, and that led to a couple of more meetings, and now an official request for a feasibility study to look at the two main route proposals.
To include the past proposal that was a northern route, which goes up through Snake Lake and then comes down to Manicotic. But the current interest we have is a southern route, which is a lot closer and possibly more efficient, which is between Kanaknak and Manicotic Airport.
Which is only approximately 14 miles, leaving from behind the Kanaknak Hospital, crossing the Snake River and tribal, municipal, and federal lands. The price tag for that 14-mile road will be high. It's too early to say yet, but an engineering firm did offer a preliminary estimate of what it may cost to build it.
Between $40 to $80 million. The reason why it's going to cost so much is to build a bridge across Snake River, and it's not a small river. It's one of the major rivers here.
Andrew says a road to Dillingham is a sensible next step for the future of Manicotic.
In approximately 1946, this community was founded by a elder who saw the opportunity for a community that will support itself not only by subsistence, fishing and gathering, but also the proximity to firewood. And then during the course, Manicotic became incorporated as a city in 1974, followed shortly with a tribal organization. And 45 years, the city has been working for and service to the community members, and that's where we stand today.
Mayor Andrew says that during recent public meetings, he heard one consistent reason attached to the idea of connecting Manicotic and Dillingham.
Or the main point, I believe, in creating this road is to open opportunities for our younger generation to get jobs. And that was the main subject of our public meeting when we were gathering information from the community.
Of course, roads go both ways. Manicotic sits in fine country with good fishing and excellent hunting opportunities. And Andrew says he and the other residents know that they'll be opening their stomping grounds to more traffic from Dillingham.
That was the fear that they had prior to the prior proposed road. They did not want outsiders to come in and use our resources. But now we are willing. The community is willing to share. I think opening up this door, as one community put it, and I used this while I was talking with Mayor Alice Ruby, is let's quit button heads and start shaking hands.
He says there's been a public outcry to see the road built within 5 years, but he thinks at least 10 years is the reality. He also believes finding the money to build it will be by far the most challenging obstacle to overcome, but he does think the road can and should get built.
I am hoping, we are hoping, that we will get this road moving along within 5-10 years. And I'm hoping to be the first one driving down to Dillingham.
Would the road from Dillingham end in Manicotic? Mayor Melvin Andrews said he doubts that and told me that some sweet day he'll drive down to Kalukuk Bay or Togiak to get some fresh clams for a Sunday brunch.
Road again, like the band, my friend. And I can't wait to get on the road again. And I can't wait to get on the road again.
Well, that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. Sunday marks the summer solstice, and while many of us wish many of you were out fishing by this day on the calendar, we do hope you have a fun and safe weekend wherever you're at. The solstice reminds me that now we're heading back the other way, slowly, and soon there will be goose and grouse, fat silvers in the river, stiffer breezes, a quieter town, and those Saturday farmers markets. But at 18 hours and 30 minutes, it'll be one long, hot day Sunday. May we all enjoy the summer fun while it lasts. I'm Dave Benninger. See you back here next week.
It's like the sun.